The following is presented as an entertainment program emphasizing folklore. It is not intended as legal or medical advice in any way and should not be used to replace the advice of legal or medical professionals. Hello and welcome to the New World Witchery Folk Magician's Notebook episode for April 2026. These are short monthly episodes that will offer a brief overview of folk magical topics and information that might be useful to you over the coming month. We highly recommend that you also pick up a reliable almanac for folk magic, such as the Witch's Almanac, Llewellyn's Astrological Pocket Planner, the Ritual Daily Planner, or your local Farmer's Almanac. Let's take a look at the moon for April of 2026. And a quick note, if I sound a little strange, it's because all the things are blooming right now and the allergies have got to me, so I apologize if my voice is a little off, but we're just going to try and get through it and get to the good stuff this month. So we begin the month with all kinds of tomfoolery, mostly because we've got a full moon on the 1st, which also happens to be April Fool's Day. The moon is in Libra here, which may rein in some of the more dramatic pranks, but will also likely mean that you're most likely to be fooled by those closest to you, so watch out for that glint in your bestie's eye. The moon then wanes in Libra on the 2nd, it goes into Virgo on the 3rd through the 4th, which may have you second-guessing some of your decisions as you head into the month. Do things that can make you feel steady and give you confidence boosts, such as wearing or carrying talismans of strength. On the 5th through the 7th, the moon continues waning in Sagittarius, and you may find yourself looking to burn some of that extra energy. This is also a good time to be clearing and weeding your garden beds if you're looking for specific energy-burning activities. The 8th through the 9th, the moon is in Capricorn, which will likely feel a little bit like the nose-to-the-grindstone period for many, possibly as they are scrambling to finish up doing taxes, but you'll get a bit of relief when it shifts into Aquarius on the 10th through the 12th. It's a good time to get out and socialize and reconnect with others to help you feel more grounded here, so hold a coven meeting, or do a divination exchange, or just get together for some coffee, tea, or games. The moon is in Pisces on the 13th through the 14th, and you might feel a bit raw emotionally here, so do things that are soothing, including ritual bathing or even just spending a bit more time in bed. Dreams are a good space to look for magic, after all. We shift into Aries on the 15th and have a new moon in Aries on the 16th, which is full of potential and desire. If you're looking to start something new, this is a good day to do it, including things like setting out your garden plans, embarking on new spellcrafts, or even undergoing initiations. The 17th through the 18th has a waxing moon in Taurus, and the 19th through the 20th, the moon grows in Gemini. These are days when you can draw upon your inner strength and turn it into outward momentum. You might feel more creative at this point, and you might want to do work to develop any magical or gardening endeavors that you started on that recent new moon. The 21st through the 22nd gives you a waxing moon in Cancer, and the energy may feel a little bit heavy, or you may simply need to take a break from magical work and do some things to restore yourself. One thing to do is go out and look up at the night sky, since the Lyrid meteor shower will be near its peak on the 22nd and up to 20 meteors per hour will be visible. On the 23rd through the 24th, the moon is in Leo, and if you've given yourself some breathing room over the days prior, you might feel a surge in determined energy that helps push you through the difficult obstacles. You might also want to revel a bit in your magic, dressing the part, and really letting people see your enchanted side. On the 25th through the 26th, you've got the moon in Virgo, and it's time to turn your to-do list into a ta-da list. Evaluate the projects that you've started and make plans to grow them, or figure out which ones need to be set aside for a future time. That works well because on the 27th, the moon will be void, of course, and it's a good time to put to rest any projects that you're not intending to maintain or work on for the foreseeable future, and give yourself the grace to do so. Think of this as a sort of pocket in the lunar calendar to store things for later. Finally, on the 28th through the 29th, we have a waxing moon in Libra, which will likely have you feeling both a need to connect with others and a need to plan and organize, and that will help you as you head into your waxing moon in Scorpio on the 30th, when you can join the other witches for your Walpurgisnacht revels, or just prepare for May Day or Beltane as you see fit. In the cards. Each month, I'll pull a card from a tarot and a playing card deck and indicate the meanings of those cards in general, then offer my own interpretations of how it could be read in actual practice. Our playing card this month is the Joker. Not everyone reads with jokers in the deck, but I usually do. I find that they add a specific element of surprise and mystery to readings, despite only having about a 3-4% chance of showing up in any reading. The Jokers represent the unknown, whether that is the enigmatic nature of fate and fortune or simply a piece of the reading being hidden from you because surprises are a necessary part of life. When the Joker comes up in a reading, I often take it to mean, wait here, and don't continue reading past this. Although if it shows up in the middle of a run of cards I will have a layout for, I'll usually finish that layout, but then won't pull any additional cards. The Joker can also remind us that we have to take our readings with a grain of salt and a sense of humor. So Joker being in a reading near a card like the Three of Clubs, representing an obstacle, may literally mean something like, you are going to stub your toe. Or it might be an indication that there's something waiting on the other side of overcoming that obstacle that's worth the effort. Along with something like the Seven of Diamonds, meaning lies and deceit, you might take that as a warning that you're being had by someone and just don't know it yet. Or it could be that your friends are planning a surprise party for you. So, if you see a Joker in a reading, don't panic, but lean into the mystery and the surprise, and try to roll with it as best you can. Our tarot card of the month is the Fool. The Fool is the beginning card of the tarot, one who exists without an actual number, as in most decks he's labeled as the Zero card, and whose journey forms the basic framework of the entire Major Arcana's journey, and in some iterations, the Minor Arcana as well. The Fool is frequently depicted as a sort of jester-like figure, dressed in motley, and carrying a bindle on a stick. A little dog chases around his feet, and he's boldly walking ahead, not even noticing he's about to head over a cliff. For many, this card indicates a warning about gullibility or naivete. The Fool is someone who's too trusting, too eager, and needs to be balanced by wisdom and guided safely to the next phase of the journey. However, the Fool is also a card of potential. Being empty and open can sometimes mean that we're more able to take on new ideas and experience new things. Also, the Fool is that power and momentum of starting something new and beginning an adventure at all. If you find a Fool card in a reading, it may just be telling you to get ready to go, because fate awaits you on the road you travel, even if you may also have some hard life lessons to learn along the way, too. Paired with a card like the Three of Cups or the Sun, you'll likely be seeing a lot of beginner's luck in your life, with opportunities presenting themselves readily. If, on the other hand, you find your card with a Seven of Swords or the Devil, you might take the Fool as a warning that someone around you is taking advantage of your trusting nature and does not have your well-being in mind. Our folk divination method of the month? Graphology or graphomancy. This month, I'm bringing you a brief overview of a form of divination that hovers somewhere between magic and pseudoscience. Graphology, and in some forms, graphomancy, this is a form of divining that is essentially used to determine aspects of a person's personality based upon their handwriting. In short, handwriting analysis. Given that literacy is something that gained ascendancy most fully during and after the Industrial Age, this method is somewhat new. I should also note that it's got a bit of a dubious history, too, and should be approached with an open mind and a touch of skepticism as well. The basic idea is that each person's handwriting has distinct characteristics that will tell you something about their personality. Some fairly innocuous examples include heavy penmanship, where the lines are dark and pushed far into the paper, indicating an energetic, active, and even forceful personality. Lighter penmanship, indicating a more yielding and accommodating person, or possibly a younger sibling used to being told what to do by older siblings, by one account. Large letters and big, elaborate writing can indicate a tendency towards extroversion, think John Hancock's signature on the Declaration of Independence here, while smaller writing can mean a more reserved and introverted personality. Big, loopy writing can indicate a warmer and more pleasant personality, while cramped writing can tell you someone is reserved or standoffish. Writing that slants to the left can indicate someone secretive and withholding. Crossing your T's tells a lot. A long, sweeping crossbar means someone is generous and gregarious, while a down-slanting, sharp crossbar can be an indication that someone is critical. Placement of the crossbar can tell you if the person is ambitious, crossing near the top of the T, or more cautious, crossing near the bottom. Even people who swear by graphology's powers of discernment when it comes to personality will tell you any one thing in a person's handwriting isn't enough to get real information. Only by looking at everything together do graphologists start a piecemeal look at a person's nature and draw conclusions. However, handwriting analysis has been used in the past as part of criminal investigations, and even turned to as a way to evaluate someone's mental state and intellectual fitness, putting it in the dubious pseudoscientific pool with methods like phrenology, divination by head shape. Racist and classist notions worm their way into many graphological interpretations, so it's worth approaching all of this while carrying several grains of salt. I should also note that it is still used in some police work, although mostly graphologists now work to match handwriting samples to other handwriting samples to determine if a person is the author of something, such as a letter that is being used as evidence in a court case, and not to determine a person's mental state or personality. One way that it could be useful, however, is by incorporating it into a practice of automatic writing. The idea is that a person writing would become a sort of vessel for a spirit to communicate. To do this, one should enter a trance-like state and copy the same sentence or passage repeatedly for a determined number of times or a certain amount of time. Then the writer and any others who wish to participate should go back through and look for changes in the writing, as well as errors, and note those errors and changes to see if they can find a message hidden among the lines. So, for example, if a person typically crosses their T with a long line, but in one iteration of the repeated sentence the T is crossed with a short, sharp line, the T would be added to a sort of letter bank, along with other similar graphological slips, and pieced together to see if a word emerges from all the letters together. It's not the most efficient method of spirit communication, perhaps, but could be a fun one to try. So, pens at the ready, and get to scribbling. A Witch's Words. The Witch's Proverb of the Month. Wise men talk because they have something to say. Fools, because they have to say something. Attributed to Plato. Our folktale this month is House of the Wind, taken from Aradia, Gospel of the Witches by Charles G. Leland. A note. This is the story recorded by Leland, but it is worth noting that he says the original story was much longer, and scholars like Ronald Hutton have cast some doubt on the veracity of his claims that his narratives were taken from real folktales. This one is an inversion of several saint tales, for example, but still has many folk elements, so we present it here for you to decide what you wish to do with it. There is a peasant's house at the beginning of the hill, or ascent leading into Volterra, and it is called the House of the Wind. Near it there once stood a small place, wherein dwelt a married couple who had but one child, a daughter, whom they adored. Truly, if the child had but a headache, they each had a worse attack from fear. Little by little the girl grew older, and all the thought of the mother, who was very devout, was that she should become a nun. But the girl did not like this, and declared that she hoped to be married like others. And when looking from her window one day, she saw and heard the birds singing in the vines, and among the trees also merrily. She said to her mother that she hoped someday to have a family of little birds of her own singing round her in a cheerful nest. At which the mother was so angry that she gave her daughter a cuff. And the young lady wept, but replied with spirit that if beaten or treated in any such manner, she would certainly find some way to escape and get married, for she had no idea of being made a nun against her will. At hearing this, the mother was seriously frightened, for she knew the spirit of her child, and was afraid lest the girl already had a lover, and would make a great scandal over the blow. And turning it all over, she thought of an elderly lady of a good family, but much reduced, who was famous for her intelligence, learning, and power of persuasion. And she thought, this will be just the person to induce my daughter to become pious, and fill her head with devotion, and make a nun of her. So she sent for this clever person, who was at once appointed the governess and constant attendant of the young lady, who, instead of quarreling with her guardian, became devoted to her. However, everything in this world does not go exactly as we would have it, and no one knows what fish or a crab may hide under a rock in a river. So it happened that the governess was not a Catholic at all, as will presently appear, and did not vex her pupil with any threats of a nun's life, or even with an approval of it. It came to pass that the young lady, who was in the habit of lying awake on moonlit nights to hear the nightingales sing, thought she heard her governess in the next room, of which the door was open. So she rose and went forth on the great balcony. The next night the same thing took place, and rising very softly and unseen, she beheld the lady praying, or at least kneeling in the moonlight, which seemed to her to be a very singular conduct, the more so because the lady kneeling uttered words which the younger could not understand, and which certainly formed no part of the Catholic Church service. And being much exercised over the strange occurrence, she at last, with timid excuses, told her governess what she'd seen. Then the latter, with a little reflection, first binding it to secrecy of life and death, for as she declared it was a matter of great peril, spoke as follows. I, like thee, was instructed when young my priests to worship an invisible god. But an old woman in whom I had great confidence once said to me, I worship a deity whom you cannot see when there is the moon in all her splendor visible. Worship her, invoke Diana, the goddess of the moon, and she will grant your prayers. This shalt thou do, obeying the Vangelo, the gospel of the witches and of Diana, who is queen of the fairies and of the moon. Now the young lady, being persuaded, was converted to the worship of Diana and the moon, and having prayed with all her heart for a lover, and having learned the conjuration to the goddess, was soon rewarded by the attention and devotion of a brave and wealthy cavalier, who was indeed as admirable a suitor as anyone could desire. But the mother, who was far more bent on gratifying vindictiveness and cruel vanity than on her daughter's happiness, was infuriated at this, and when the gentleman came to her, she bade him be gone, for her daughter was vowed to become a nun, and a nun she should be or die. Then the young lady was shut up in a cell in a tower, without even the company of her governess, and put to strong and hard pain, being made to sleep on the stone floor, and would have died of hunger had her mother had her way. Then, in this dire need, she prayed to Diana to set her free, when lo, she found the prison door unfastened and easily escaped. Then, having obtained a pilgrim's dress, she traveled far and wide, teaching and preaching the religion of the old times, the religion of Diana, the queen of the fairies and of the moon, of the goddess of the poor and of the oppressed. And the fame of her wisdom and beauty went forth all over the land, and the people worshipped her, calling her La Bella Pellegrina. At last her mother, hearing of her, was in a greater rage than ever, and, after much trouble, succeeded in having her again arrested and cast into prison. Then, in an evil temper, she asked her whether she would become a nun, to which she replied it was not possible, because she had left the Catholic Church and become a worshipper of Diana and the moon. And the end of it was that the mother, regarding her daughter as lost, gave her up to the priests to be put to torture and death, as they did to all who would not agree with them or left their religion. But the people were not well pleased with this, because they adored the beauty and the goodness of the girl, and there are few who had not enjoyed her charity. By the aid of her lover, she obtained at last grace, that on the night before she was to be tortured and executed, she might with a guard go forth into the garden of the palace and pray. This she did, and standing by the door of the house, which is still there, prayed in the light of the full moon to Diana that she might be delivered from dire persecution to which she had been subjected, since even her own parents had willingly given her over to an awful death. Now her parents and the priests, and all who sought her death, were in the palace, watching lest she should escape. When lo, in answer to her prayer, there came a terrible tempest and an overwhelming wind, a storm such as man had never seen before, which overthrew and swept away the palace and all who were in it. There was not one stone left upon the other, nor one soul left alive of all who were there. The gods had replied to her prayer. The young lady escaped happily with her lover, wedded him, and the house of the peasant where the lady stood is still called La Casa El Viento, or the House of the Wind. Book Review: The Witch's Devil by Roger J. Horn. Our book this month is The Witch's Devil by Roger J. Horn. We read this book for our Patreon book club back in fall of 2023 and had a good discussion of it then. Horn is an amateur folklorist and writer-practitioner of folk witchcraft tomes, including A Cartomancy Guide and a Broad Overview of Folk Magical Practices. His books are published by Moon Over the Mountain Press, which may be his own publication company since they only seem to publish his books. Horn's book, On the Devil, takes on a topic that is often a tricky one to address in discussions of witchcraft. I've fielded many questions about the role the devils play in folk belief and witchery, and for some, even a hint of the diabolical presence is enough to send them into a fury of condemnation, while others are innately drawn to the idea of Old Horny being part of the craft of the wise, or some such fanciful description of witchcraft. Horn very deftly looks at the devil, not as a single figure aligned with the Christian concept of Satanism, but rather as a sort of umbrella term for a variety of folk figures that can be adversarial, but potentially helpful as well. In one of the later chapters, he says, "Our devil's nature is not singular but pluralistic, encompassing many different titles and meanings over the ages, a vast sea fed by so many rivers." This is very much what you find in The Witch's Devil as a book, with Horn probing a wide variety of primarily European folklore to uncover a whole bevy of devils lurking beneath the surface. He explores the idea of the devil being a figure summoned and bound by a necromancer or a ceremonial magician, and the Faustian bargains that can be struck through that method. And he also looks into the lore of the devil as a witch's initiator, providing her with additional power and tools once she's proven herself. He does not shy away from aspects of Christian devilry, although he mostly examines these through the lens of folk Christianity and its many varied practices. And he draws upon fairy tales and legends like the Jack-o'-lantern tale to expand upon the devil's role in magical lore. He also discusses the power of naming the devil outright as part of one's practice and claiming that mixture of fear and awe that seems to arise anytime one mingles diabolism and folk witchery together. There are practical elements scattered throughout the book, including invocations and even a brief guide to psalm magic, too. Horn's sources are varied, mostly publicly accessible accounts and folktales, as well as books like Leland's Aradia, or medieval grimoires like The Lesser Key of Solomon, and he does indicate where much of his lore is coming from. There are occasional nods to diabolic lore beyond Europe, such as a dip into North American colonial-era folklore by way of Cotton Mather's text The Invisible World, but by and large, this is concerned with the history of the devil and witchcraft centered on Western sources, largely from late antiquity up until around the Edwardian period at the latest. It's laid out in a fun way, making it look and feel like an older book due to font choices and margins, and there are frequent line and woodcut illustrations throughout. If you're interested in exploring the tricksy figure of the devil and witchcraft, this is certainly a reasonable jumping-off point to begin, and an opportunity to shake hands with Old Scratch as well. Materia Magica. Hagstones, or holy stones. We know lots of witches love their rocks, but most people seem to think of stones and sorcery based on particular mineral varieties imbued with special properties, think rose quartz for love and so forth. But the average rock plucked from the ground can also have its own magical lore. Perhaps the most powerful average magical stone is the Holdstone, sometimes called the Holy Stone or the Hagstone. These are rocks that have a natural hole in them, usually found in or near riverbeds, or the sea because the water erodes the gaps in the stone. Lore about the stones is found in various parts of Western Europe and North America. In parts of Britain, very large stones with holes in them are treated as magic portals that have fairy magic in them, capable of healing those who pass through them. In Cornwall, for example, a large stone in the parish of Madron was used by parents to pass young children through to cure them of rickets, which is usually caused by calcium deficiency. Smaller holy stones were often strung up and put over beds to stave off nightmares and other evil spirits during the vulnerable sleeping hours. Red thread or ribbon was preferred for this, and the stones could also be worn around the neck for such protections. One account notes that they were tied to the keys of one's house, which would bar any evil sorcery from being worked against the household, sort of like an anti-hex key ring. There's an example of one in the collection at the Pitt Rivers Museum in England, which describes the artifact as a holdstone used for the purposes of keeping away witches. Sarah Lawless notes of these holdstones that in the UK it was used as a protection charm, as the locals believed that tying their front door key or stable key to a holdstone would protect the building it was hung upon. They can also be placed along the windowsill as a barrier against bad magic. Holy stones are thought to be very lucky, even if not kept. One bit of lore says that a string of holdstones anchored with the breastbones of kingfishers, a type of bird, would act as a charm against evil spirits. An account from 1889 says that children would find them, spit on them, and toss them over their shoulders, saying, lucky stone, go over my head, and bring me some good luck before I go to bed. Still another bit of lore connects them to childbirth, noting that a hag stone hung over the bed where the birth is taking place will make the delivery smoother and less painful. There seems to be some belief that one can peer through the hole as well and see the unseen world of spirits and fairies. This bit of lore was taken up in the popular children's book series, The Spiderwick Chronicles, by Tony DiTerlizzi and Holly Black. If you've ever seen the Studio Leica children's horror movie, Coraline, you may remember the holdstone the heroine uses to locate the small spheres holding onto the spirits of children trapped by the wicked Other Mother. In the Mormon tradition, the common name for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there's a belief that the founder of the faith, Joseph Smith, used mystical stones known as the Seer Stone, as well as two spectacle or interpreter stones to translate the mysterious plates of the Book of Mormon. Smith connected these stones to the divinatory stones from the breastplate of Aaron, known as Urim and Thummim. But some representations also connected these to the tradition of looking through holed stones to find hidden things. And given that Smith and his father operated as treasure hunters before Smith found the golden plates bearing the text he translated, that makes some sense. So if you're out and about and manage to find a holy stone, then you've just managed to acquire a pretty powerful natural magical object. And you don't even have to polish it. Just maybe be careful when looking through it, as you never know what you might see. Creature Corner. The Hodag. If you're up in the timber country of northern Wisconsin, you might run into the legend of a creature called the Hodag. What was the Hodag? Well, according to folklorist Charles E. Brown, the ferocious beast had horns on its head, large, bulging eyes, terrible horns and claws. A line of large, sharp spikes ran down the ridge of its back and long tail. The Hodag never laid down. It slept leaning against the trunks of trees as well. It could only be captured by cutting deeply into the trunks of its favorite trees. It was said to eat mud turtles, water snakes, and muskrats, and it did not disdain human flesh. You can find photos of lumberjacks surrounding the body of a captured hodag online fairly easily, and people have been sharing hodag tales for well over a century at this point. In 1896, one was even captured, and you could pay a nickel to go see it at the Oneida County Fair. True, the tent where it was kept dark and dim, and it didn't do anything, but you could almost make out the horns along its back and the strange leathery hide and the weak light. That was worth 5 cents, wasn't it? The Hodag represents one of North America's fearsome critters or legendary creatures. Some are creatures that people really do believe to exist in some form, such as the jackalope we covered last month, which might have roots in people seeing real jackrabbits with bony protrusions due to a disease, but are mostly rogue taxidermy jokes. In many cases, fearsome critters are sort of a practical joke, a way of hazing a believing population into thinking some sort of strange creature is in their midst. With the Hodag, the person behind the critter was a man named E.S. Gene Shepherd, who, along with a woodcarver named Luke Kearney, fabricated a Hodag out of things like leather and cattle horns to trick gullible folks into parting with their hard-earned nickels for a bit of fun. Eventually, the Hodag hoax was revealed. But funnily enough, these sorts of jokes can take on a life of their own, and a few lumberjacks began circulating the tale of the Hodag in their midst as a way of razzing newcomers into the area. It was basically the equivalent of the summer camp tradition of the snipe hunt, and the Hodag eventually became so loved that some small towns in Wisconsin have adopted the fearsome beastie as their mascot. So if you happen to be up that way, keep an eye out for Hodags. And who knows, maybe you'll spot a real one. Our feedback this month is a comment going all the way back to our episode 15 about grimoires and magical books from listener Jennifer. Jennifer says, I enjoy making journals, and I love so many of them that I actually have 3 books of shadows that I made myself. I have a folk magic book of shadows, 2 regular books of shadows, and a zodiac sign journal / book of shadows. They have these amazing hardcover journals at the dollar store with beautiful paper inside, and it's hardcover spiral ring, and how they're amazing. I could go on and on about all the journals I have. I have an herbal journal I created on all the plants I've collected as well. And Jennifer, thank you for sharing that. We love this here at New World Butchery and the Folk Magician's Notebook. Big fans of, you know, basically taking, you know, journals and not being afraid to use them. One of the things that we talked about on our show quite a bit was the concept of the commonplace book and the idea that you would just sort of put in whatever you needed in that book, right? Like that could be family recipes, that could be, important information about like the moon, could be book reviews, there are things that you've been reading. It's kind of what this episode is all about, right? This Folk Magician's Notebook is kind of a mishmash of lots of things. And these became things that would be passed down for generations and carry lots of information forward. So big fans of this. Also big fan of the idea of something like smash booking, which is, just putting stuff into these notebooks, gluing them in, not getting too concerned about making them pretty, but just making them functional, making them something where stuff all gets collected and you know where it is and you can go back to it. So I really enjoy the kind of like improvisational nature of this and just sort of being like, yes, this is going to be my herbal journal, and just putting everything in there, right? Not being afraid to use that. So big fan of that. Big fan of, you know, things like zines as well. You know, spiral bound notebooks we love because you can lay them flat. That's fantastic. And, you know, even the idea of like taking a, you know, 3-ring binder or something like that, and using that as a sort of journal where you can add and subtract pages, or, you know, even a nice, you know, Trapper Keeper, Book of Shadows is a fun idea. So we just, wanted to share this because we appreciate getting the feedback even on kind of old episodes, but then also just, you know, we want to encourage people as you're heading into spring, as you're kind of doing the season of renewal and this sort of starting new things and, you know, getting yourself spring cleaning, getting, you know, things going, you know, don't be afraid to get a little messy. You know, get out there and do the work, do the fun stuff. It's not going to be perfect. You're going to have pages of the journal you may need to scratch out. You may need to rip out. You may need to glue something over them, but that's okay. All of that still makes your journal yours and makes it magical. So we encourage that. So thank you, Jennifer, for writing in. That will do it for us this time around. We're going to have this out probably just a day or two later than we normally would, and I apologize for that. It's just been, I've been not feeling great because of the allergies, so I got a little behind on that. But hopefully you still find this useful, still find some of this information valuable, and yeah, if you like it, please share it around. Let folks know about us. Let folks come find us and interact with our notebook here. If you have thoughts that you want to share, you want to send us feedback, you can leave comments on any of our episodes, especially on places like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Those are the ones that we find most easily, but you know, anywhere you leave them, we kind of comb through and try to find those. And if you want to send something directly to us, you can do that at newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com or compassandkey @gmail.com. Both of those will reach us. You can also stop by our website, newworldwitchery.com. If you click on the Find Us tab, you'll wind up with all of our social media. So we're on Instagram, YouTube, mostly those places at this point. We don't tend to go a lot into the other places anymore, but you know, we do still occasionally pop around. So if you want to leave us messages in those places as well, please feel free to do that. And you can also even join our Patreon, which, you know, $1 a month, whatever you can afford to support us, gets you some access to some cool stuff. We get these notebooks out early. We have a little Google Calendar full of Folk Magicians notebook stuff that you can download as a member. All kinds of fun little stuff going on there. If you want to stop by, that's also patreon.com/newworldwitchery if you're looking for that. So, and that will do it for us this time around. Again, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you doing that, and we'll be back again next month. But until then, thanks for listening. Be well.